Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And it is time for a classic episode of Tech Stuff. This episode originally published way back on October 15th, 2014. It is titled, Do We Need Humanoid Robots? An interesting question, because we often, at least, I don't know, I can't say we, I often think of robots as sort of anthropomorphic robots. Like, I think of droids in the Star Wars, like C-3PO, that kind of droid, not R2. He's clearly not humanoid. But, you know, I think of humanoid robots more frequently than other types, despite the fact that the vast majority of robots I've encountered have not been humanoid robots. So that does raise a question. Does a humanoid robot even make sense? We try and answer that in this particular episode. Enjoy.
I asked Josh what he would like to cover, because with the fact that I've got all these guests coming in to sit down with me, you know, some people like to come up with their own suggestions. Some people prefer it if I pick a topic and then they research it. Mm-hmm. I asked Josh what he would like to talk about, and you were really interested in the idea of humanoid robots.
Well, you have this awesome spreadsheet of listener suggestions.
Yeah.
And it might as well have been a neon when I was going down the sheet. I'm like, humanoid robots, of course.
And this is a great topic. In order to really get into it, I was going to define a few terms, even though a lot of these are ones that I think most of us just kind of understand just from the fact that this is in our culture now. It's mm-hmm. not just a reality as far as technology goes, but it plays a large part in fiction. In fact, that's where the term robot comes from, is from fiction.
Right.
It was from Karel Čapek, a Czechoslovakian playwright.
Did you look up that pronunciation?
I did, in fact, listen to it a couple of times. Karel Čapek. Because his last name is spelled C-A-P-E-K, and it includes symbols that are not in the English alphabet.
Right.
Above, like, squiggly lines and little UFOs and things. He wrote R-U-R, also known as Rossum's Universal Robots. And the word robot comes from the Czech word robota, which means forced labor.
Yeah.
So a robot is an entity, a synthetic construct that is forced to do work. Then we have humanoid, which just means resembling a human being.
Right.
That's a term that is relatively young. It started showing up around the turn of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it started, I think the first few times it was ever mentioned was around 1912. And it was mostly used then to describe fossils, saying these are humanoid fossils.
Oh, kind of like what hominid became.
Yeah. And then we have android, which is, we're probably not going to be using that word very often, but android is a robot that's in the form of a human. So all androids are robots, but not all robots are androids.
And, you know, I ran into, I looked up android as well.
Yeah.
And apparently that's from like the early 18th century.
It's a little odd that it actually predates robots.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when we look at myths and legends, there's so many stories that involve a human-like entity that's mm-hmm. not actually a person
yep.
that you can see where it gets translated in there. This gets a little confusing, too, because Star Wars, they called all their robots droids.
Right.
But they aren't androids. R2-D2 is not an android because he's not, or it's not human-shaped. You could even argue that C-3PO is not a true android because some people say, to be an android, you have to appear at least on casual glance to be human.
He's way too shiny.
Way too shiny.
Yeah.
Data from Star Trek Next Generation might be android, but
yeah.
He's an android who's had a long time in the man cave. He hasn't seen much sun.
Right.
Yeah, because he's definitely got a weird complexion thing going.
Oh, he's translucent.
The kid in AI would be an android.
David.
Yes.
Which turns out to be a popular name for droids.
Wow.
Because there's David in AI, and there was also David in Prometheus.
Oh, you know, I never saw Prometheus.
I don't know if your listeners are going to agree with me or not, because mm-hmm. I could see it getting shouted down, but I thought Prometheus was a great movie.
Okay.
Even upon second viewing, I thought it was good.
You know, I know that from the artistic level, mm-hmm. a lot of people really loved it, and then there were some people who said, how can you get lost if you have a three-dimensional map
yeah.
with you at all times? But, you know, plot versus artist, I don't know.
Yeah.
Then you've got replicants from Blade Runner. These are more like cyborgs because they have some sort of organic material attached to them. They're not completely 100%, synthetic material.
Yeah.
So Terminator's another example. They have a fleshy overskin on top of their metallic bodies.
But was that real skin that he had? Or was it synthetic skin? Because that would make a difference.
That's a good question. And I know that they refer to them as cyborgs at least a few times in the movies, mm-hmm. which would suggest that it's actual skin. Maybe it's lab-grown human skin.
Yeah.
So, there's some fuzzy lines around these definitions.
I would think that cyborgs would be the hardest of all of the humanoid robots to make because the flesh would just rot. Like you'd have
yeah.
your normal looking humanoid robot, your cyborg, and its ear would just fall off.
Yeah, and it's not as easy as you might think to wire together the wetware that's in our heads
mm-hmm.
with hardware that runs on circuits. We often think of computers working in a way that's similar to our brains, but in fact, the two work in very different ways.
Well, it seems like running into this, though, Strickland, the more we got into humanoid robotics,
uh-huh.
the more we started to understand just how complex we are.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is a benefit of study of humanoid robotics. Mm-hmm. The idea of pursuing the goal of creating a humanoid robot is not just that we learn more about all the different areas in robotics, and there are a lot, and we'll talk about some of them. But we also learn more about ourselves.
Right.
I mean, we're trying to figure out, okay, if we're going to make something that is able to perform tasks the way a human does, then we really got to take a close look at humans.
Right.
That's the first place to start. So what makes a humanoid robot? And generally speaking, we're talking about a robot that has basic features, usually at minimum a torso, arms and legs,
right.
and is walking upright. It may have a head or it might not. Early humanoid robots didn't, or at least their sensory instruments were all located within the top part of the torso. There wasn't
right.
like a separate head.
Did you see a picture of Minerva at the Smithsonian?
No, I did not.
It's a robot tour guide, but she came up in the humanoid robot research, and I think she's stretching it a little
yeah.
bit. Yeah, she looks a bit like a washing machine with a couple of cameras on top. So just those alone, I guess, makes her eligible for the humanoid robot realm, but I thought she was stretching
that
a little
that
bit.
Seems like that's a bit of a, you know, if it has an appendage, that doesn't necessarily make it humanoid. I mean, you could look at the Mars Curiosity rover, which mm-hmm. has several appendages, mm-hmm. but I don't think anyone would ever describe it as humanoid.
Right.
So ideally, a humanoid robot would be able to interact with humans mm-hmm. within a human environment, because here's the thing about we people, we have defined our environments to a large extent, especially in developed nations, where the stuff that's around us, we have shaped so that it works within our capabilities.
Right. With our human environment thus yep. far. If you look at technology, though, on the whole, we've pretty much been forced to adapt to it.
Yeah.
So, for example, like a keyboard, we don't normally naturally, you know, express ideas through our fingers on a little board.
Right.
We don't normally do that. So we had to adapt to the technology and learn to type and get good at it. With humanoid robots, it's basically going the exact opposite.
Right.
It's saying we already have an environment. We already are, you know, good at all of this other stuff. If we're going to make humanoid robots, one of the great benefits is they can adapt to us.
Right. Yeah, we don't have to create a unitasker robot that's really good at one thing
mm-hmm.
That may or may not be something that humans can do easily. We can make a robot that's good at lots of things. I also think usually when I think of humanoid robots, when I think of robots in general,
mm-hmm.
I normally think that they are at least semi-autonomous. That's one of the things I usually think of. It doesn't necessarily have to be. You could have a teleoperated robot.
Right.
But I almost think of that closer to the realm of like a remote controlled car
yeah.
or a puppet
right.
even. So I often, one of the definitions I use is that it's an autonomous or semi-autonomous machine
right.
in human form. It's mechanical and electronic, and it can thus do the sort of things humans do, but do it in a totally synthetic way.
And you have to be careful when you say autonomous or semi-autonomous, because the state of the art right now appears to be that robots display autonomy because they just kind of wander off in places they're not supposed to.
Right.
But it's not because they want to. It's because their program just ran afoul of
right.
its programmers.
Right. There's no determination there on the part of the robot.
Yeah.
It's not exploring its environment on its own accord. Mm-hmm. It's someone made a mistake in the code somewhere
mm-hmm.
and where the robot was supposed to take a left-hand turn at this one, you know, predetermined spot, it instead continued forward or something.
Exactly.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of humanoid robots. And if you want to look way, way, way back, I mean, we're talking about the first people to really kind of attempt to build a humanoid machine mm-hmm. that could mimic or the movements, at least, of a person. You got to go all the way back to Greece between the years 10 and 70 Common Era. That's when Hero of Alexandria started to create various machines. He's also the person who made the first working steam engine style tool.
Which is pretty impressive for
yeah.
that time.
Yeah, he had come up with a lot of very clever designs. Whether they were built or not depends upon certain accounts
mm-hmm.
and if they're true. But the stuff he designed is completely buildable. So
right.
he didn't come up with any ideas where it was so, you know, outlandish that was impossible.
Right. He wasn't just like drawing in the margins of his diary or something.
No. Yeah. He came up with specific plans that people today have recreated. They built their own
wow.
versions. Yeah.
Neat.
So he created a lot of designs for automata, although these are things that were controlled by pulleys and ropes and cogged wheels and needed some form of outside influence to make them work. So they're not all fully self-contained.
Mm-hmm.
So not a big surprise.
Like the Showbiz Pizza Rockafire Explosion Band.
Yeah,
something.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. One of those audio animatronic figures uh-huh. that looks very robotic, but you realize it's really just one tiny piece of a giant system.
Yeah.
In 1495, we get up to Leonardo da Vinci. He mm-hmm. designed an automaton in the form of a mechanical knight, which, again, supposedly he built. There's no actual record of an existing one from history,
right.
but they have created ones based on the design since then. And it could do things like move its arms and raise its visor.
Who's doing this?
Who's doing this?
Yeah, who's
crazy engineers who are also very excited about history.
And very wealthy, too, I would imagine.
Yeah. So in this case, you're talking about Mark Rosheim,
mm-hmm.
who recreated this particular machine. And it's a knight in German medieval armor.
Uh-huh.
And it can sit down, it can stand up, it can move its arms, it can raise a visor, it can work its jaw.
Wow. That's got to be unsettling.
I imagine so. I tried to find video of Rosheim's version working, and I couldn't find it. He did, however, make another of Da Vinci's inventions, which was a self-driving cart that used you wound a spring, and it had cam stops that would allow it to steer a predetermined path. You would actually program the cart.
Wow.
By putting cam stops in particular locations along the cam, mm-hmm. and that would tell it when to turn left or when to turn right. So it couldn't navigate through an obstacle course unless you had already previously seen the obstacle course and you could figure out when it needed to turn
right.
ahead of time. So you're essentially programming the device. There are lots of examples in the Renaissance of automata and semi-automata, things that were really more like puppets. Mm-hmm. You've heard about the Mechanical Turk?
No, I haven't.
It's the chess-playing robot.
Wow.
So it looked like it was a robot that could play chess and was really, really good at playing chess. And it turned out eventually to be a hoax. It was actually a puppet, and there was an actual chess master hidden in a cabinet beneath the Mechanical Turk who sat kind of Indian style with a chessboard in front of him and could move the pieces to where it needed to be. But it was all being guided by an actual chess master who was hidden underneath.
When was that?
That was late Renaissance, early Enlightenment.
That in and of itself is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was neat that people were thinking about these sort of things. Mm-hmm. By 1926, we get the first humanoid robot to appear on film,
mm-hmm.
Metropolis, mm-hmm. the character of Maria. And at 1939, at the World's Fair, Westinghouse Electric Corporation showed off a robot called Electro.
Uh-huh.
Now, have you ever seen this?
No.
So he kind of looks like the Tin Man from the Wizard of Oz film.
I have seen him, yes.
He smokes.
I have seen
it's
him,
one of
yes.
the things he can do.
Yeah.
He had a little bellows in his head
right.
that allowed him to puff smoke. He could also kind of speak. He had a 78 revolution per minute record player essentially inside of him.
Could he cough?
I suppose if the needle skipped, it would at least sound like it. He would repeat himself over. He called the audience Toots. That was the
so
name.
He's like a robot grandpa.
Yeah, apparently the main reason he was retired from being shown off at exhibitions was because it was very dated kind of lingo.
Yeah,
but he was used at the 1939 World's Fair, which was a. It's funny because I'll be talking about that again in another episode very shortly. The 1939 World's Fair would have been an amazing thing to visit.
I'm more of a 64 man myself.
I can understand that. But if you're going to get to the point where you're looking at full-scale anthropomorphic robots, mm-hmm. you got to get up to about 1973. That's when the Waybot 1 from the Waseda University came out. That was the first full-scale anthropomorphic robot developed in the world. Which had limb control, a vision system, so it had an optical system that could recognize its environment and objects.
And measure distance.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it also had a conversation system. It was actually a collection of a bunch of very complex machinery, like mm-hmm. its hands had been previously developed independently of the robot, so had its legs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like all these people coming up with these various pieces saying, all right, let's connect all this together and see what happens. So
that was a huge, huge leap forward.
Yeah.
You know, if you'll notice, we went basically from hoaxy chess playing Turks
right.
to, you know, a robot that could converse and interact with its environment.
Yep.
And then it seems like we kind of went off course for a little bit. And now we're coming full circle back to that, where, like you said, a lot of different disciplines are contributing these different pieces to what will eventually be all of the best practices from each little sub-discipline put together
yeah.
in, you know, the true humanoid robot.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we're talking about a humanoid robot that's capable of interacting with people as if they were, you know, their own person, mm-hmm. even though maybe an odd person, mm-hmm. not like the kind of person you would typically run into, it's a multidisciplinary approach. I mean, artificial intelligence by itself is multidisciplinary.
Sure.
Because you have sensing, you have, so all the perception, there's all these different, just that's multidisciplinary.
Right.
Then you've got the processing, the cognition, things like planning, navigation. There are so many things that come together to make a humanoid robot a possibility. And that's just the mental side, right? Then you have all the physical side, the how do you make it walk? Right. How do you make it keep its balance? So lots of stuff to consider there.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will look more at the issue of humanoid robots.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Waybot 2 came out in 1980. That was a specialist robot. It could play a keyboard, an electronic keyboard.
Yeah.
It could read sheet music and play music. It was, because it was a specialist, it was not able to do the general functions that its predecessor could do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the issues in robotics today is that it's very challenging to build a general purpose robot. It's much easier to take a specific task that you need to have done and
right.
design a robot to do that.
Yeah, because, I mean, we already have those. They're called Roombas.
Roombas and rovers.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's also, all the robots in manufacturing, all the welding robots, things like that. 1989, Pacific Northwest National Laboratory built a robot called Manny. That was the first full-scale android body, and it had 42 degrees of freedom, but no AI or autonomy. It was completely teleoperated.
And it took me a couple of times to figure out what degrees of freedom meant.
Yeah.
I thought it meant like it could move its arm 42 degrees. Basically, but a degree of freedom is, say, like it can move its wrist. That's a degree of freedom.
Right.
It can turn its head
right.
left and right. That's a degree of freedom, right?
Right. And if you look at the human hand, the human hand has about 30 degrees of freedom, meaning that you look at the way each finger and your thumb can move. You look at the way you can clench a fist. You can twist your hand with your wrist. Those are all different degrees of freedom. And in fact, one of the cool things about robots is that as we get better and better at designing them, we can create robots that have far more degrees of freedom than the human body does. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea of a humanoid robot in the future that has a 360-degree motion with its wrist and then just having it change light bulbs. Because it would just spin and not have to do the little twisty-turny motion.
How many robots does it take to change the light bulbs?
Just the one. Yeah. Just that one.
Just the one $4 billion robot.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not saying it's an efficient system. I'm just saying I'm an supremely lazy human being with tall ceilings. In 1996, Honda introduced the P2 robot, which was a self-contained robotic humanoid. It could walk and climb stairs. Mm-hmm. The P3 followed in 1997. And in 2002, Honda introduced my good buddy, Asimo.
Uh-huh.
As the first article I wrote for How Stuff Works was Asimo Works.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Have you done an episode on it?
I have not done a full episode on Asimo. I even was offered the opportunity to meet Asimo when I first wrote the article, but it would have meant having to travel to Disneyland to do it. And at the time, How Stuff Works was not prepared to do such a thing.
Oh, back in those days, eh?
I went to Disneyland by myself, with my wife, and we went and saw the Asimo production. Uh-huh. And at the end of it, I talked to one of the Disney cast members, and I said, yeah, I wrote the article about how Asimo works for How Stuff Works. And she said, hang on a minute. And I got to meet Asimo.
And it was a man in a suit, right?
It was actually a collection of cats that had been duct taped right. together and then plastic. No, it was a working robot.
That's pretty neat. How blown away were you?
I was very much blown away. It was cool seeing it up close. I mean, it looks like a little tiny astronaut.
Right, because he's got like the faceplate especially.
I love that people call it he. People give, and I do this all the time too, with robots. I'll assign a gender, even though technically many of them are specifically genderless. Asimo uh-huh. is supposed to be genderless, but I often refer to Asimo as a he as well.
Well, you know why? It's the shoulders, I would guess.
Yeah.
They go straight across and far out. That's very masculine, no matter what.
Yeah.
And you need that, I would guess. You need shoulders in a humanoid robot with flexible arms.
Well, and also, I'm sure every single element of Asimo is built with the balance in mind, because Asimo mm-hmm. is the first robot that can run.
Yes, I've seen him run. It's gawky.
Yeah, it kind of looks like someone who really needs to get to the bathroom.
Right.
It's a little bit of a hoppy kind of run.
Yeah.
But the definition of run here is that there are moments where both feet are off the ground.
Right.
So walking, you always have one foot in contact with the ground, and running, both feet at some point are out of contact. And that's a huge deal for robotics.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, you have a machine that completely separates itself from contact on the ground. It has no propulsion to keep it upright.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have like propellers or jets or anything like that. So you have to design it so it can propel itself off the ground and then catch itself when it comes back down without mm-hmm. falling over. Mm-hmm. And that is a non-trivial challenge.
No, it's an enormous challenge that roboticists have really kind of started to tackle lately. One of the ways that they've overcome it is with rounded feet,
yeah,
which are very helpful in keeping balance and allowing it to run. But there's drawbacks to it as well. Like the robot can't start itself.
Mm-hmm.
It also can't stop. So it can't stop moving.
Yeah.
Which is not something you want. Like there's still some challenges there ahead of the roboticists who are learning to teach a robot to walk. And even the ones that have taught robots to walk, they typically can just walk over flat surfaces with no obstacles.
Right.
When they encounter stairs, they're in trouble. But then you have robots that know how to go upstairs,
yeah,
but they can't walk on a flat surface.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, all this information, all this knowledge will be brought together, and you'll have a robot that can walk no problem.
Right. In fact, this kind of transitions nicely into those challenges that face designers of humanoid robots. Mm-hmm. And locomotion is probably one of the top ones, at least from the physical engineering side.
Yeah.
For example, you know, Asimo can go up and down stairs, but that is a little deceptive because Asimo has to be programmed to go up or down the staircase and know exactly how many stairs are involved.
Right.
It's not a case of Asimo detecting a staircase and then navigating through, up or down it. It's the fact that, all right, now we're initiating your stair climbing program.
Exactly.
And
remember, we
practiced
this.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of like smoke and mirrors robotics.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
Is the point that it's at.
But that's, you know, those are the little, no pun intended, those are the little steps you have to take in order to get to the destination.
What do you mean, no pun intended? I don't buy that at all.
You know, I started saying it without thinking about it. And then, I mean,
well, okay.
You know, but then I did follow through with it. So right. I guess there was some intention there at the end. But Yeah, they're also not very good at going across any kind of uneven terrain, mm-hmm. right? So humanoid robots in particular find it very difficult to maintain balance over anything that's not either a flat surface or, in the case of robots that can, go up or down stairs mm-hmm. and stairs. So if you're talking about like a sidewalk that is not completely even, that would be enough to give a robot trouble because it's going to try and put its foot down to where it would believe the ground to be. And if the ground's not exactly level, then that's
robot fall down.
Yeah, because they can't really catch their balance very well. Now, there are robots that can, but they are four-legged.
Yeah, you've seen an advantage.
You've seen the big dog video?
No, I saw the army robo mules, though.
It's very similar. Yeah. Big Dog is essentially a robo mule type development. It is a four-legged robot that is able to maintain its balance even when pushed. And the famous video shows the robo dog, the big dog, kind of jogging, and then a guy just casually lifts his leg up and kicks the robo dog.
Right.
Like he essentially puts the bottom of his foot against the side of it and pushes really hard.
Like cow tipping.
And you see the big dog stumble. It actually stumbles and then catches itself and then rights itself and continues on. And almost everyone has an emotional reaction to this. Like, how dare that evil man kick that poor defenseless robot?
Yeah.
The robot can't feel anything. But that robot is gasoline powered. So,
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the big disadvantages of keeping it inside.
You wouldn't want to have one of these indoors.
No, you don't bring your lawnmower indoors.
No, and the pistons that allow it to do this are quite loud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a subtle system at all. So a lot of work has to go into creating better systems for robots to maintain their balance in order for the locomotion problem to really be solved.
And again, I mean, like anybody who's seen Short Circuit knows that you can build a robot like Johnny Five with arms and a head and a torso and then like traction wheels,
treads,
and it can go anywhere over terrain. It can go up steps. Probably the thing is again, you have to remember when it comes to humanoid robots, you're trying to make the robot that can adapt to the human world.
Right.
So if you had somebody like Johnny Five as your house butler or something, you couldn't have an island in your kitchen. And who doesn't love an island in their kitchen?
Right. Right.
Johnny Five couldn't maneuver around it because he's too wide.
Yeah. You wouldn't be able to have any space that would be narrower than the robot's body.
Exactly. And that's not what you want.
Yeah.
With humanoid robots.
It wouldn't work well in my house. I've got a flat style house mm-hmm. where there's three floors.
Oh, you have a flat style.
Yeah. Well, it's like flat, like European flat, not flat as in there's only one level. There are actually three of them. Four if you count the rooftop deck. So
that counts.
It makes it, you know, any robot that would not be able to navigate stairs easily would definitely have an issue, which is the main reason why I don't have a Roomba, because I don't want to hear the sound of a Roomba going falling down a flight of stairs. But at any rate, that's a great point. Moving on from locomotion, there's also dexterous manipulation.
Yeah, I think that point bears repeating. What we just talked about was locomotion.
Yeah.
And this is you and I, a couple of non-robot experts talking about the problem with locomotion. That's just one of myriad challenges facing humanoid robotics designers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's one that's easy to point to because it's something that we all, you know, end up at least observing or participating in all the time.
Yeah.
And we take it for granted.
Yeah.
But then when you think, okay, well, how do I make a machine that does that? You start to realize, ooh, this is, you know, even if I have a leg that has lots of different degrees of freedom and points of articulation,
mm-hmm.
I still have to design the upper part of the robot so that it does not unbalance the lower part. And if it does unbalance, that it's able to catch itself. You know, some people just describe walking as falling and catching yourself over and over again.
Yeah, those people are nuts.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not walking right.
No, I describe walking as something that other people do. I like to keep my walking to a minimum.
I thought you walked a lot.
Actually, I do.
Okay.
I just joke about being lazy.
I think moving forward, falling down and catching your balance every time, that's lurching.
Yeah.
That's a lurch.
Well, as an Adams Family fan, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But dexterous manipulation would be the ability to pick up and manipulate objects.
Yeah.
Now, we're really good at that. We humans, you know, we can feel an object and decide at that point how to handle it, even if we've never encountered that kind of object before. So if I encounter something I've never seen before and I've ascertained that it's safe for me to touch it, I can touch it, I can feel it, I can get a feel for how heavy it is, I can get a feel for how delicate it might be.
Yeah.
And then I can adjust on the fly so that I can handle it appropriately, where I'm not going to hurt myself, I'm not going to hurt the object. Robots are not so good at that.
No. Crush, kill.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if they don't mean to.
Right, yeah. If the robot's grip is too strong, it can break the object. If it's too weak, the object slips from its grip and it falls. And it may not be able to distinguish between different types. So getting those tactile sensors where a robot can tell how tightly it's gripping something and how much pressure a particular object can take before you've reached the failure point is a big deal. Now, this is also a big deal for just making robots safe for humans to be around.
It is a big deal. You know that the first fatality by robot occurred at the business end of a robotic arm in Flat Rock, Michigan in 1979. A man named Robert Williams, who's working on a Ford line.
Yeah.
His robot arm was moving a little slow for his taste in getting supplies down. So he climbed up to where the supplies were. The robot arm suddenly sped up and hit him in the head and killed him instantly.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've had a chance to see some of these industrial robots, and I would say up close, but you can't because of instances like that. Industrial robots usually have lots of safety barriers around them because it's not safe to be near those robots when they're in operation. They can't react.
Exactly. So you leave it up to the humans to stay away from the robots,
right?
Because we haven't gotten to the point where the robots know to not crush you or hit you in the head.
Right. Yeah.
It's not the robot's fault.
I'm looking forward to that day when they figure out not to crush me.
Yes.
It's been pretty lousy days so far. When I toured the Georgia Tech robotics lab.
Oh, neat.
They talked specifically about this. This is a real challenge, having robots recognize and react in a way that's going to be safe around humans. And but dexterous manipulation that's only a part of dexterous manipulation. Obviously, the rest of it is, again, that object recognition and handling so that you're not destroying whatever it is you're trying to pick up.
Yeah.
Another big challenge in designing robots in general, not just humanoid robots, is just the perception, the sensory perception of the robot.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah. So, you know, whether it's optical systems, like actual cameras in the place of eyes, or infrared so that you can see even in low light situations, radar, LIDAR. I mean, there's tons of different ways of sensing.
Echolocation.
Yep. There's, you know, sensing obviously is not just sight. Then you have to have the sound.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really tricky one, actually, because for us humans, we can kind of zero in on what's important, right? So if you and I were at a party, which, you know, someone made a mistake and invited me, we could have a conversation and be able to carry that conversation on even within the context of a big bustling party,
right?
Because we can focus on what the other person is saying.
It's called a latent inhibition.
Yeah. So
and when you don't have that, that's schizophrenia.
Yeah. You can't separate the signal from the noise,
right?
And everything either becomes noise or everything becomes signal.
Mm-hmm.
So for a robot that might, for example, require verbal commands, that's really tricky. What if you have the television on and someone's saying something on TV and you are trying to get your robot to do something and it's not quite sure what to do because it's hearing these different commands and isn't sure who to obey?
Yeah, you are the person pitching the bacon bowl.
Right, right, exactly. Well, let's say that you are, you know, trying to get some help in the kitchen, but it just keeps hearing CSI Miami and say, kill Billy. And then next thing you know, you're just desperately trying to tell the robot, please don't kill Billy.
Exactly.
Well, that's a silly example. It's a real problem. And then there's the tactile, the tactile sensors, like the making sure you don't crush something that's delicate. That falls into perception. Smell can also fall into perception.
Yeah.
You might want to have humanoid robots that work in areas where the humanoid robot can alert humans to the presence of things that might be toxic. You know, this isn't necessarily just the robot butler we're talking about.
Right.
This could be robots that work in areas that might be dangerous for humans. And that would be an important element, too.
It's not a robot, but NASA already has a sensor that senses things like ammonia or smoke. It can actually sense smoke, artificially smell smoke before the fires actually started, ignited.
Interesting.
Yeah, because, so you know, it's such a dangerous proposition.
Right. Yes, clearly for anything NASA related.
Yeah. But they can also sense ammonia because, you know, a lot of their refrigeration systems run on ammonia, and you can't have an ammonia leak on the space station.
Right, right. And, I mean, the same thing is true for, I mean, I've heard of robots that are used in mining operations, which, you know, if you come upon a pocket of natural gas, that can be a real danger.
Sure.
That sort of stuff. Then you've got the back end of the sensory perception. That's where you have the actual interpretation of the data.
Yeah, that's a big one.
That's huge.
Because not only do you need to have a robot that can has binocular vision, so it has a depth of field.
Right.
It also has to know what it's doing.
Yeah.
And what that information means and how to apply it to adapt to changes.
Right, right. So if I were to show you, Josh, a series of pictures of various types of dogs, mm-hmm. you would very quickly pick up on the things that mean dog. Like, you would understand the concept of dog pretty quickly.
Sure.
Robots and various other computers, machines, they have a lot harder problem with this. If whatever they're looking at doesn't exactly match the parameters of the example, it's very difficult for a machine to extrapolate and say, oh, this other thing I'm looking at relates to this thing I know, even though the two examples aren't identical.
Right.
So the same thing could be true for any object. Let's just use a coffee mug. And let's say that you use a plain white coffee mug of average size as the example for the robot. And then the robot encounters a larger blue coffee mug and the handle is turned the other way.
Yeah.
The robot might be completely befuddled by this.
Yeah.
So this is a real problem in artificial intelligence, is object identification, so that a robot knows what it's looking at and also understands the context that that object fills within the environment.
Right.
So it's not just that, oh, that's a mug. It's, oh, that's a mug. A mug is a container. I can put things into that mug.
Yes.
Here are the things that can go in the mug. Here are the things that absolutely should not go in the mug, like Billy. Those are the kind of things that...
Billy.
Yeah, Billy. Well, you know, we're going to need another Billy.
We'll make a robot, Billy.
Yeah, in which case you could just churn those suckers out, right? Mass production of Billy. But yeah, artificial intelligence, an enormous problem. And that, of course, is not just with robotics. That's a field unto itself, and robotics is just one branch that relies upon artificial intelligence.
And it's, from what I came across, it looked like just out of the gate, I guess it was said at a university, they tried to build a robot that was just like high functioning.
Yeah.
And they realized, like, we have no idea what we're doing.
Yeah, that Waybot 1 was able to converse at the level, or was able to have a cognitive function equivalent to a 1.5-year-old person.
Which, I have to say, when we're talking right out of the gate.
Yeah, very impressive.
Very impressive.
Yeah.
Because we're not that much further along now.
Right.
But what they found from making Waybot 1 was, okay, this is way more difficult than we thought.
Yeah.
You can't just program every kind of coffee cup in the world.
Right.
And even if you could, then you also have to program every kind of table and every kind of light. And we need to come at this in a different way. And so they realized, number one, humans are extraordinarily more complex than we thought before.
Yes.
And then number two, humans make a pretty good model for a humanoid robot in the realm of things like perception and information systems and learning.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so they went to these different disciplines like neurobiology, neurology, psychology, and they said, what can we learn from you guys about how humans do this that we can apply to robots? And since they started taking those steps, it seems like humanoid robotics has gotten its footing a little more.
Yeah, and we're seeing so many developments in other areas of AI that are really promising. I always bring up IBM's Watson because its natural language recognition was phenomenal. The ability for it to parse clues in Jeopardy and come up with the appropriate answer, knowing that Jeopardy, those clues are not always straightforward.
Right.
And it, again, illustrates the complexity that we humans navigate without much trouble, because this is the world we've created. But then we realize, ooh, if we make a machine that's mostly, when you get down to it, based on yes or no,
right.
A one or a zero, true or false, and you're trying to build complex behaviors off of something that is incredibly simple when you boil it down to its basic element, that's where you're like, ooh, this is going to require a lot of work. I mean, IBM's Watson was an enormous machine with thousands of microprocessors just so it could be able to play Jeopardy.
Right.
That's a very specific function, too.
We'll be right back after this next break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
So creating a robot that is able to navigate and interact with a human environment and be able to interact with humans in a way that makes sense is a big challenge. Also, just the way that a robot would socialize with humans is a huge challenge.
Right.
How do you make a robot that is able to respond to commands and cues in an appropriate way? And the appropriate way is the key there, because humans are pretty complex and we can be very subtle in many ways.
Yeah, we speak unplainly. We use sarcasm.
Yep.
We use a lot of gestures.
Yep.
Rather than just words.
Yep. There's a lot that goes into human communication that, if you are a human, is pretty much natural. Especially, I mean, if you're a human within that particular culture,
right,
and you're familiar with that culture, because anyone who has traveled extensively knows there are cultures where things that would be commonplace at home are very different in the place where you happen to be right then.
Right.
And it may be that something that is completely innocent at home is an offensive gesture in the place where you are now. Well, imagine a robot that is not programmed to handle these kind of subtle communication methods.
Yeah, and he walks around giving the finger to everybody.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
He doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah. He doesn't know. He's just doing as he was programmed. But even beyond that, something that you brought up in our research when we were planning this was the uncanny valley.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah.
I'd never read that paper before, and I'm glad I did.
is really interesting, yeah. Right? Yeah. So the Uncanny Valley, for those who are not familiar with the term, it describes when we start to approach artificial humans that look almost, but not quite, like real humans. Mm-hmm. And by look, I don't necessarily just mean the physical appearance. I also mean their behaviors, their movements.
Right.
So if you were to look out and see a figure that from a distance looked like it was a human figure, and you start walking towards it just thinking this is another person, and then they start moving in a very herky-jerky motion, mm-hmm. very mechanical mm-hmm. motion, then you're likely going to have a negative emotional response. Often revulsion is one of the words used very
creepiness,
frequently. Yeah.
That's another one.
I mean, I remember the CGI movies that were almost to the point of photorealism where they look like people for the most part, but there's not, something's just not quite right with the eyes.
It's their soul. They're missing yes, their soul. There's like Beowulf is yeah. a good example. Mm-hmm. And Polar Express.
Polar Express is the one that everyone brings up.
Apparently did not do very well because of the Uncanny Valley. That's what they blame it on.
Yeah. And the same thing applies to robots. So in fact, I saw a robot that was really disturbing to me. It was an art exhibit. An installation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a robot of Confucius in a cell filled with monkeys and the live monkeys, real monkeys, and the robot would just thrash around wildly. It was the stuff of nightmares.
I've got to see that.
I'll show it to you after
the
show.
Man alive.
Yeah. So these are all big challenges, and some of them are going to be harder for us than others. Mm-hmm. It may be that the engineering challenges of locomotion are solved well before we ever get a real grip on all the artificial intelligence problems, or it could be the other way around. But it is multidisciplinary. That's a big, big issue. So there are some people who argue for humanoid robots. There are people who argue against humanoid robots.
Where do you land?
I think research and development with humanoid robots is important because by having the goal of creating a humanoid robot, you drive the research and development process. You have a specific goal in mind.
Right.
And in order to achieve that goal, you know what sort of problems you have to solve. And even if we never enter a future where humanoid robots are a common thing,
mm-hmm.
even if they are mostly used as something in an exhibition or for PR or whatever, even if that's the only use for them, we're going to benefit from the research and development of making that possible in ways we can't anticipate.
Well, yeah, and the more we get into humanoid robotics, the more we understand humans.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much the only argument I've seen that stands up in favor of doing humanoid robots.
Yeah, because it's expensive and it's hard. I mean, it's really a difficult problem. And it's to build a humanoid robot, something that is capable of being a general purpose robot.
Right.
It's, you know, it's hard to anticipate all the things you're going to need to be able to do. If you're talking general purpose and adaptable, that's really tough. I mean, we didn't even talk about the adaptability problem very much. We talked a little bit about a robot capable of learning from other people,
which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, that's one way, just watching humans and then mimicking humans.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of robot learning. There's also, the way where it's controlled through virtual reality by
yep.
a human, and it just kind of logs the motions the human's making it do. Like there's a NASA has a Robonaut mm-hmm. that learns like that. So I think there's a lot of benefit to investigating artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Like you want your Nest at home
mm-hmm.
to learn so you don't have to keep adjusting the thermostat. That counts. That's
yeah.
that's machine learning.
Yeah.
To me, the big argument against having humanoid robots and the quagmire that seems to begin is sociability.
Yeah.
That seems to be the whole reason anybody wants a humanoid robot, because you can make, you know, you have a Roomba and
yeah.
it vacuums. You can make a driverless car. As Olivia Solon wrote in Wired a couple of years back.
Yeah.
You know, why do you have to make a robot butler to park the car? Just make a car that parks itself.
Right.
And it seems like that's where we're going right now.
Yeah.
So when you add this extra layer of humanoid, you add all of this additional problems and troubles and redundancies.
Mm-hmm.
Like for example, if you're going to make a humanoid robot that throws a ball, this humanoid robot to appear real needs to have a little bit of follow through.
Yep.
But as far as the robot, the machine is concerned, it can throw the ball and just stop.
Yeah.
Right where the release is. It doesn't need to go anymore, but it's going to look weird and robotic.
Yeah.
If you want to get past that uncanny valley, which is another problem, the thing has to have follow through. That's totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
You can make a robot that can throw a ball, and the goal is to throw the ball.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to add the follow through, but you do when you're making it a sociable humanoid robot. So it seems like that's the path that will lead everyone astray that I don't get.
Yeah, I like the idea of designing robots for specific tasks because you can really focus on getting the task done. So there, I see this as two separate branches.
Yeah,
I see the branch of developing the humanoid robot as pushing forward a lot of different areas of thought that mm-hmm. could be applied in multiple disciplines so that we'll benefit from that. I see the development of robots as unitaskers as being important to actually handle the jobs that are the three Ds. That's dirty, difficult, and dangerous.
Yeah.
All right. So those are the jobs that maybe they revolve a lot of repetition, which can cause injury over time, or it can lead to mistakes because you've done the same task so many times that you start to kind of zone out.
Right.
Robots will never zone out. If it's a dirty job where it's something that's undesirable by people, robots don't care. Mm-hmm. They'll do that. Or if it's dangerous, if it's bomb disposal, or if it's something like the Mars Curiosity rover, these are dangerous jobs that you wouldn't necessarily want to put a human into if you had the alternative.
You're right.
So all of these things, that's where robots really make sense to me. To go to the places that are difficult for us to go to. Maybe that's, you know, deep sea exploration, space exploration, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Or to do jobs that might be dangerous, having a first responder robot to survey a scene to make sure that a structure is remaining solid while maybe there was a fire and it has to make sure that it's not going to collapse in on rescue
right.
mission. That kind of stuff.
But do you need those things to come out and be able to tell a joke or something?
No.
What's the point?
And most of them don't need to be any sort of humanoid form factor either, which greatly simplifies the actual development of the robot and thus cuts down on the cost. So you can achieve the task you're trying to achieve
mm-hmm.
for less money than if you were trying to build this general purpose machine.
So then we come to this ultimate question. Why? What's the purpose of humanoid robots?
Well, I think the purpose is twofold. One is, again, to have that specific goal in mind that allows you to define where your end point is.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that when you have that defined end goal, it makes it easier for you to build on the things you need to achieve it, as opposed to having an open goal where it's just, I want to improve AI. That's so open that it's hard to get direction from it. But
right.
if you think, I need to have an artificial intelligence that will allow a robot to... here's a great example. Let's say that the challenge is to have a robot leave a room, go down a flight of stairs,
mm-hmm.
leave a building, get into a vehicle, drive the vehicle to a different location, get out of the vehicle, go into another building, break through a wall, and put out a fire. That's a real actual robotics challenge.
That is indeed quite a challenge.
Yeah. Dr. Henrik Christensen told me about this. It really is a challenge. It's not just a real challenge. It's a real challenge. It's
like a Google challenge?
Like a DARPA challenge.
Ah, I gotcha.
So it's he was telling me about this, and you start to think about all the things that have to fall in line for you to be able to achieve this goal. That is a valuable thing. But I think the other thing is the social aspect. I think that there are people who would benefit from a robot that is able to give some form of social comfort. Let's say for the elderly who need to have some form of interaction, that could actually be a really valuable tool. And in fact, there's a lot of work that's going into robotics to help people like the elderly who may have real emotional and psychological problems due to loneliness.
Do you think that robots are the answer to that?
I think that robots can help. I don't know. I would never go so far as to say answer.
But couldn't you also make the argument that if you created robots that displaced human jobs and also simultaneously said, hey, this nursing home sector mm-hmm. is about to explode because we've got a bunch of baby boomers and ways of society have now decided that our elderly need human interaction more than we've carried it out before.
Mm-hmm.
So let's create this whole other industry, or let's expand this industry of elderly caretakers and fill those jobs with people who've been displaced by worker robots. Wouldn't that be better?
That might be. Or you could, again, looking at the way a lot of roboticists frame this, they say, all right, well, it is a reality that robots are taking over actual jobs.
Right.
But the hope is that it also ends up creating new jobs that are better paying jobs, less dangerous jobs. More old folks friendly.
Yeah.
The idea being that it frees up people and encourages the pursuit of jobs in engineering, in computer science.
Right.
Now, we live in the real world and we understand that it's a lot more complex than telling someone who's been working on a manufacturing line, hey, I'm sorry, your job's gone because there's a robot here. But guess what? Right. We have an opening in engineering. So if you just go and pursue a 4-year degree and then some postgraduate work, you'll be right back to work. That's obviously not something that's going to be easy, especially in the short term.
Right.
But the long term hope is that more and more of these jobs that are dangerous for people or less desirable for people will be taken up by robots, and then there will be the creation of better jobs that are higher up on the food chain.
And I think that makes sense. To me, it's just once you enter the sociability.
Yeah.
And because without sociability, there's no reason to create a humanoid robot. Everything else can look like a robot.
Yeah.
So it's when you enter sociability that you lose me.
Not only does it, can it look like a robot? But we can still socialize with it, even if it doesn't look like a human. There's the story that 80% of Roomba owners name their Roomba.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we end up having these kind of emotional attachments and investments in things that don't look, not only do they not look human, they don't look like any other animal that we would interact with on a like owner or and pet or whatever. I mean, they're just a robot. So I think at the end of the day, Josh, I think we're on the same page. We think humanoid robots are an interesting idea, but not necessarily the end goal.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot of incentive to go after it for its own purposes. We can see the benefits of going after it in the sense of the developments that are made in that pursuit help us in other ways. And that wraps up this classic episode of Tech Stuff. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have suggestions for topics I should cover in future episodes, please reach out to me on Twitter. The handle for the show is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Pacaso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.